Hey, y'all, and welcome back to Group Therapy. I'm one of your hosts, licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Casey.
I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. Jessica Rabin.
I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. J.
And I am licensed clinical social worker, Kristen Gingrich, because I didn't want to do a dissertation.
And we're back.
We're back
from the holiday break. So today we're talking about how all of the generations perceive mental health. So settle in, take a seat, and welcome to Group Therapy. I hope everybody had a really good holiday and Happy New Year. I know I did. I tried to make some New Year's resolutions and I'm already breaking all my rules. So I decided to not do one this year because I just can't do it. So wanted to start us off with some questions. So what generation, for all of you guys, what generation makes up the most of your client base? I always find this so interesting and fascinating.
Gen Z.
Really?
And I think, and I have a couple Gen Alpha.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be Gen Z, but it's really close behind Millennial. Like, it's Gen Z, mm-hmm. then Millennial, and it might just be by, like, mm-hmm. two or three clients.
Yeah, mine right now in my current role is Gen X.
Wow.
What about you?
Yeah, majority of mine are Millennial. Millennial, and actually, now that I think about it, I feel like it's Millennial, and then I'm caught between Gen Z and Gen X right now. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. interesting.
The whole spectrum.
Yeah. Let's walk through it. Does anybody know like the ages or like the years that each generation is from? I figure our listeners would want to know.
I made a cheat sheet.
Oh, just
also,
the cheat sheets.
Side note, there's like disagreement on some of like the generations, especially when we get to like Gen Z, Gen Alpha. Mm-hmm. But of people still alive, the oldest generation is the greatest generation, which was 1901 to 1927, which I realized my grandmother was in the greatest generation because she was 1927.
Wow.
And she's still alive. Yeah. Then we have the silent generation. So that's 1928 to 1945. Then baby boomers. So that's 1946 to 1964. Gen X, 1965 to 1980. Millennials, 1981 to 1996. I see some things say 95, some 97, but the thing I saw most frequently was 96. Gen Z, 97 to... I've seen anywhere from 2009 to 2012 range. And then Gen Alpha, anywhere from 2010 to 13, depending on when people think Gen Z ends, to 2025. So in next, or I guess after next year, we'll have a new generation.
That is wild. I thought Gen X, I think I'm confusing Gen X and baby boomer because I'm thinking about my parents' age and I totally thought they were Gen X, but now I'm realizing that they're like right on the cusp and I don't want to tell them. I don't want to disappoint them and make that impression known. I feel like you're actually a baby boomer.
And it does matter because, and we'll get into this, but like, if you're like a late baby boomer, like 1963, think of the different life events that you've witnessed compared to someone born in 1946. So when people are like, I'm a late millennial or an elder millennial, it does. Some people are like, oh, everything's got a label nowadays, but it does matter because it depends when you got technology and what that childhood looked like. So there are differences if you're later in some of these gaps than earlier.
Yeah. I think about that a lot with my husband. Is the oldest of five, if you consider his stepbrothers, but between him and his biological youngest brother is 9 years. And so even though they're both this same generation, their lived experience, even growing up in the same household, same parents, is totally different because of him being more middle, elder, millennial, and then my brother-in-law literally being 96.
I'm thinking of when they got cell phones too, like or with Jess's situation, right? It's like, it's so different because one of them grew up with a cell phone way long, you know what I mean? For majority of their life. Anyway, Kristen, what were you going to say?
Well, and that's where like, when you see these overlaps, I think that's where you see like the term millennial come in, where like the people born more towards like the 1995 line who err on the side more of like the Gen Z versus, I don't know any other terms other than Zillennial.
There's,
Jess, do you know?
So the only reason I know this is because of the polls, not to jump ahead, but I don't know how to say it because I would also say it Zillennial, but with the X, like the cusp between Gen X and Millennial.
Yeah.
So
I'm not an English teacher, so I
don't know how to say it, but like people born 80, 81, some feel like they're more Gen X, some feel like they're more Millennial.
I even think like just growing up in the 80s versus the 90s, I don't know what it's like growing up in the 80s, but like growing up in the 90s versus the 80s, like literally it's just to Justin's point, like there's so many different life experiences that happen and big events and world events that happen that like, I even think too about like, you know, 9/11 or something like that and how younger generations are like, we should ask our elder millennials or old people. And it's like, wait, we're not that old.
Or when Gen Z refers to the 1900s, but like they literally mean like 1999.
Yeah.
They're like back in the 1900s. Also, I was going to be like, Justin, tell us about growing up in the 80s to make an old person joke.
Oh shit, Justin, I'm sorry.
I mean, I had a solid 3 months in the 80s, you know, good times.
I had four months
in the 80s.
That's what's so weird about it, because like I always refer to myself as a 90s child because my childhood was in the 90s. So when people are like, I'm a 90s child, I was born in 94, I'm like, you didn't experience the whole 90s. I experienced the whole 90s from 5 to 15. Why did I hesitate on that math?
New Year. What is 5 plus 10?
From 5 to 15, like that was my whole childhood was the 90s. Mm-hmm. The 80s, I don't, like I was 5 years old and younger. Like, I don't really remember much, but I think I think what you grow up in those formative years matters greatly. Like, if you grew up from 2000 to 2008, that was so different than my 90s childhood, obviously, technology.
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say that, Justin. I was going to say, like, even for me, right? Like, I was born in 91. So technically, I had the entire, but I identify mostly as an early 2000s kid.
Mm-hmm.
Because those more formative years, because it's like I can remember a good chunk of the end of the 90s, but like I don't remember those were not my formative years. Like I got a solid 5 years that I don't remember shit from.
Mm-hmm.
Like
that's so funny. What do you guys think? Like the strengths of each generation are, if you could think of any. Like things that certain generations are really good at. I was trying to think of this before the podcast, and I feel like there's a little bit of overlap.
Go
ahead. You cheated. I cheated.
I was up on reading the articles, and I was like looking at values of each and like how that correlates with their lived experience and like events. And I was fascinated by that because a lot of it I hadn't thought about. Like the Silent Generation went through World War II, Pearl Harbor, the stock market crash. And so they were big on conformity, self-sacrifice, discipline, hard work. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. But we don't do this like in our day-to-day life. You don't pause and reflect of the events that you endured, especially through your formative years, will have a drastic impact on your values. Because then I thought about like, you know, more Gen X into millennial, but I was really thinking about Gen X kind of going through Woodstock and like sort of like individuality movement and like how opposite the values sort of are for a lot of Gen Xers. And that would be my mom compared to something like the Silent Generation where we all came together for World War II.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. I even think too, like with the Silent Generation, that's like when my grandparents, you know, when they lived, and I keep thinking of like the wisdom that they taught me, right? Like I always think about like the things that they said and they're like, just keep working and like, make sure you contribute and like all this stuff. And then my parents, they worked really hard, but they're like, take a break, you know, you take a little bit of a break, you know, don't work so hard. So I do wonder if like you said, those different generations have those different experiences. And I wonder if there's like deflectors within each one too. You know, if there are people that are like, I don't really want to conform because of this, if they're like the opposite, you know?
Well, I think that that's what happens through the parenting aspect of it, right? They're parented, every person is parented from a previous generation. And so they learn. And so then they learn, like, even for us, we learned what worked for them and what we're seeing what doesn't work for them. So now we're passing on, like, what, Oliver's Gen Alpha? So, like, I'm passing on borderline boomer Gen Xer parenting, changing it to millennial parenting to my Gen Xer. And when my Gen Xer, not Gen Xer, Gen Zer, Alpha, I don't know, whatever Alpha generation he is, there's too many letters. When he starts, like, it, and we learn through that. And I think, like, we try to take those strengths, but also figure out where those strengths no longer fit within the current world.
Right.
True.
Yeah. Justin, I love that you brought up, like, values and lived experience, because, you know, tying it into kind of perceptions of mental health. And when I was doing my reading, like, you know, we can, you know, there's all those, like, boomer jokes on that. Okay, boomer. Or, like, we can, like, criticize, especially older generations, for not talking about mental health as much. And obviously we'll get into it. But, like, I think about their lived experience and, like, why or how that probably shaped their perceptions of mental health. So, kind of opening up the discussion, what are some, like, stereotypes you think of with different generations when it comes to, like, mental health and therapy seeking, positive or negative?
I think the biggest takeaway for me is I do evaluations with veterans. I know I talk about this all the time, but I see veterans who served in, like, the Korean War and Vietnam. And then I see veterans who have served in the Iraq War. And then I see veterans who are just getting into the military, you know? So when I think about all of those different generations, I always ask, have you ever seen behavioral health for any reason when you're in the military? And Korean War vets, for those who are still alive, and then Vietnam veterans, almost always they say absolutely not. Like, never. Mm-hmm. I would never, ever. And I get the military is a different institution, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they were like, why would I see mental health? You know? And I'm like, 'cause you experienced a lot of stuff over there. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, you just kind of keep it moving. And then veterans who are a little younger are coming to me for evaluations. They're like, oh yeah, I have a counselor, you know? So I do wonder if, like, even within a system like the military, there's messages, you know, and the older generations will tell me, oh, if I was, if I saw behavioral health, I would not have a job. Like, I wouldn't be able to do my job. And even afterwards, I wouldn't be able to do my job, you know? And now, like, with younger veterans, I'm noticing that they have resources and they're able to still work, you know? So that's, at least in my line of work, that's what I see the most. And I do wonder if, like, the perception back then was similar to what Justin's saying, you just kind of keep it moving. And I wonder if that kind of translates to everywhere you are.
Mm-hmm. No, I would agree with that. I think that that was, like, that's one of that perseverance, that keep going, that moving forward. We don't have time to sit in this. And I think too, kind of looping it into what you said, K-10, is a lot of things changed with mental health over the course of time, right? Treatment today in 2024 looks vastly different than what treatment looked like in the 1960s.
True.
Like, just like, it's like night and day in that capacity. And even just when you talk about, like, K-10, you talked about the impact on work. Like, laws have been made to protect you that, you know, you can't get fired for having a mental illness. You can't, like, all of those things. And so, but back then, I don't know when that stuff came into effect. But, like, I can imagine that, you know, in the 1930s, the 1940s, that probably was not there. And so that really impacts someone's willingness to want to seek treatment. And two, did we have names for some of these things back then? Like, I remember reading this book on autism, and it was just talking about, like, oh, autism is this newfangled thing. Like, this is a new thing. And someone was like, no, these were the kids who were held on the farms and didn't talk to anybody and, like, just worked on the farm all day. And, like, but way back when, because they didn't have a name for it. And I think that's also a piece now, is that we have that versus maybe where we came from before.
And KBI, I love that you brought up like the differences in treatment and stuff. Cause like, if we think of kind of mental health care, like insane asylums, and I'm putting that in quotes, mm-hmm. but using that, cause that's what they were called, were not disbanded until the 1970s. So like, if we have, you know, people that were born in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and they think of mental health care as these insane asylums, mm-hmm. and that's what mental health is, of course you're not gonna talk about those things. Another interesting thing I read, which I hadn't really like connected, because we talk about, I think a stereotype for like boomers is like, oh, you just don't talk about mental health. Mm-hmm. But if you think of, especially the boomers like born maybe like 50s or early 60s, their teen years, early 20s were the 70s. And that was, you know, not only like psychedelics, but like very much like love, peace, self-growth, self-journey. So you don't need mental health care. Like all your problems are solved through like personal growth, self-help, healing. So why would you seek out extra help if that was kind of the cultural shift at that time, which I hadn't considered until I was reading up about this. But I was like, no, that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think I was also thinking about how anything new first gets dispensed to the people with the most privilege. So I'm thinking about the 1950s was the time that a lot of, in America, Carl Rogers' therapy was starting to boom. We were starting to get behaviorism, had been a thing, but was also being implemented in forms of therapy. I'm thinking about the types of people who probably had access when it first hit the market is people with the most privilege. Because at that same time, you had the start of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to internalize that of like, this is in the mid, you know, 19th century. People are fighting for their basic rights. And there's also this thing called therapy. That's why when sometimes people reflect of like, oh, different cultures, why are they, you know, more closed off to therapy? It's like they've only had their civil rights for, you know, a few dozen years. Oh, and so you think of the decades that have to go through and people get implemented into, you know, having access to a vote, or their basic health care, you know, a decent education, all the things. We could talk about disparities that still exist, of course. But there's a reason why a lot of cultural backgrounds, you're just skeptical of it. It's not as familiar. Mm-hmm. Your parents didn't have access to this. So I think about that. Can I think about, I always reflect for myself of like, oh, no one ever talked about mental health in the 90s. Like no one, anxiety, depression, like no one mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And yet I still had the privilege that, you know, my dad was dying of cancer and I was having all these panic attacks. My mom still was able to put me in therapy, even though I had no idea what it was. So again, I'm just kind of reflecting and thinking about how that is a big factor as well, the disparity that still exists and how that intersects with people's thoughts about therapy in general.
I'm so happy you brought it up because I think psychology has traditionally and still is like a white dominated field, you know? I mean, think about it. So I think for people of color, to your point, it's like they've had less time to digest that it could be helpful. And then less time to even think about like, do I even have access? Mm-hmm. And then is this person actually going to see me? Cause I don't see people like me doing this, you know? So it's like probably harder to gain access, even if you have the opportunity, because you don't trust it, you know? I mean, which is totally reasonable, 100%.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Justin, when you were talking to and reflecting on like, nobody talked about mental health in the 90s, but like you had a mom that recognized that you would benefit from therapy, you had privilege with access to going to therapy. I think it's also interesting to think about like the shifts of when we grew up versus where we are now. Like all of us are millennials, and I would argue millennials and Gen Z are definitely the most open about mental health, Gen Z being
for sure
more open. But I would also argue that's only happened probably within the past 10 years.
100%.
It wasn't when we were growing up. Mm-mm. It was when we became adults or were in adulthood, really. Because even with Gen X, like especially some of the younger Gen Xers, like late 70s, like, you know, I've connected with people that are like, yeah, I grew up and never talked about mental health, but now I'm talking about it. So it's not even just generations. It's like where people are in that generation and like how things have changed over time. Cause yeah, I agree with you, Justin, even though I'm a few years younger than you, like I first went to therapy, I think it was 2004, but at that time I knew nobody in therapy.
Yeah.
Like I like it wasn't talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
My friend Lindsay, shout out to Lindsay if you listen to this, went to my parents and was basically like, hey, I think Jess needs some help. But if it wasn't for her,
mm-hmm.
like yeah. knew nobody in therapy. And now I don't know a single person that hasn't been in therapy. Yeah. Like in adulthood. Like in yeah. my people I'm friends with. So
mm-hmm. yeah, I think it's tough too, because I think a lot of times we might frown upon the older generations and say, oh, they're mm-hmm. not with it, or they don't know like mental health stuff. Like, I think it's really important to understand the context too. And then sure. obviously like there's a lot for us to learn, which is understandable. But I just think about living in a time in which you have absolutely no resources and you can't put a name to what you're experiencing. Like my grandmother had like apparently 3 mental breakdowns and they're like, oh, she's hysterical. Like we still don't know what happened. Like she was just like, yeah, I just had a mental breakdown one day. And we were like, what are you talking about? Like what was going on? Like, or what happened? And she's like, I don't know. It just happened. And she still like literally had no words for like what actually happened. And I think about if that were to happen today, we might say, oh yeah, I'm in a major depressive episode, or, you know, I'm really struggling like with my anxiety or something like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe, who knows? But I think now we have the language for it, whereas in the past people didn't. And I think that's so important to like be sensitive to. Mm-hmm. Really for like the older generations. Even my mom struggles. I'm like, you can't say that. She's like, okay, got it. Say it this way. Be more kind and gentle with mental health terms, mom, please. And she's like, okay, got it.
Oh, Donna. I also think of like media influences. And obviously now we have social media access to information. Mm-hmm. But like if we think of, and we did a whole episode on like TV film,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think of like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which what came out in the 70s, or like even Fatal Attraction, which was what, late 80s, mm-hmm. I think. But like mm-hmm. how mental health still has a long way to go to be depicted accurately, as we did in our whole episode. But you think of like the films that were out when, you know, boomers, Gen X were growing up that even talked about mental health, it was totally stigmatized and like, mm-hmm. people were labeled as like crazy and stuff. So, you know, that was another thing I think about that's influencing kind mm-hmm. of perceptions mm-hmm. of mental health and those stigmas. And we all know here how hard it is to like unlearn what we've been taught, yeah. unlearn stigmas and things like that. So if the only messages you see are, well, insane asylums and these very stigmatized, stereotyped films, absolutely, you're not going to talk about when you're struggling. Mm-hmm.
Who would? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I don't want to be thrown into a quote-unquote insane asylum. You know what I mean? Like, why would anybody want to open
absolutely.
Up?
Absolutely.
Well, and then because you're not talking about it because of that, then you're not talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. so versus like now, like we are like people are talking about it. Because we're moving away from that. And so it just kind of created that perpetual cycle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I even think we can notice that. I know the DSM has a lot of limitations, but I even noticed like if you look at the past of the DSMs and how like certain things were mental disorders and some aren't now, you know, it's like, yeah. I think we were trying to figure it out, you know, like throughout the years. But another thing, I wanted to get KBI's thoughts on this because you are more well-versed in this than I am. But I even think like substance use treatment, like in the past, mm-hmm. it was just like, okay, detox. And now I notice there's like, for most, at least most of my clients who have gone to detox or something like that, there's a mental health component now. Whereas in the past, if I talk to older generations, they're like, yeah, I just got sober and I left. You know, there was no talking. I don't know what your thoughts are on that and how it's progressed.
Well, yeah, I think we started seeing the link between mental health and substance use and that it became kind of that perpetual cycle. Mm-hmm. It is a rarity. I don't think I've ever come across someone so far in my practice who has a struggle with substance use, whether a full substance use disorder or just struggles, who is not also struggling with something on the other end. Maybe it's not fully diagnosable as something, but you're not struggling with something. And I think, you know, again, like, especially with that substance use, once we start identifying and talking about those things, then we're more accurately able to treat the substance use, right? We look at a lot of Vietnam veterans and things like that who actively have a lot of substance use, especially with alcohol. And, you know, again, we go back to the military being its own thing as far as talking about our feelings, because, right, talking about your feelings in the military when you're active duty gets you really harmed, as far as, like, you have to sit in logic. And I think we've talked about that before. But unlearning things like that in order to address the substance use as well can be really, really hard, and sitting in both of those. But yeah, they tend to be a nice little cycle that we sometimes don't even realize that there's an underlying piece to it.
I also think the theme around a lot of things we're discussing is like having compassion. And I think one thing I've realized in doing this reflection with you all in another episode that was all about technology, is there's something about millennial and Gen Z where we are so used to adapting quickly because of technology that you don't realize that that's a muscle that gets strengthened over time. Where I know for like baby boomers and other people who got technology when they're 45 or later, you don't realize that change happens slower. The access to information, acquiring a new skill, all these things. I think sometimes, and I get it, like Gen Z will be like, all the information you could ever need is right there on the internet. Just like watch some YouTube, like get the and change. But I think there's also like in having conversation with my mom and other people, it's like you are flexing a muscle that you've had your whole life, where other generations, again, might have tried to acquire this at 55. The older I get, the more compassion I have for that, of like the things are, that are most ingrained in me are stuff that I learned early on. And it does get harder to adapt and change. It's not an excuse, but it is something I think about where I'm like, yeah, I know how to jump on YouTube easily. Watching older generations navigate something that I think simple, like YouTube interface, is like wild. I'm like, yo, why are you clicking there? Like, what are you doing over here? Don't click this suggested video. Like, stay here. It's just an ad. Yeah. Like, don't click on that ad. But like, stuff we don't even think about.
Yeah, I think like once there's a generation who's younger than you, like Gen Z, you know, from us millennials, I think that too now. I'm like, ooh, I'm dropping the ball on some stuff. You know what I mean? And then you're like, oh, I have more compassion for older generations now.
I'm like, oh, I feel old now. Thanks. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I agree with that. Like that, like watching, like obviously like we are not quite in that position, but I know that when we are in like our 40s, 50s, and 60s, we're going to see that another huge shift with something happen. And we are going to be in that same boat where we are going to be that struggle. And the impact that that has, I think that, right, my mother-in-law complains all the time that, why do I have to download an app for this? Oh, I have to make another account just to check out on this website? Like, I remember my dad, like, being like, I'm never ordering anything online. What? Why? Like, and it's just like, but like right. For me, I'm like, I order my groceries online. Like, and so I think that comes back to like what you said, Justin, is that compassion is like, yes, do sometimes I literally sit like this when I'm talking about anything technology related to my parents? Absolutely. Because I'm like, it's just a remote, guys. It's just a remote. It's the Roku. It's made to be easy. But I also have to remember that I've been dealing with a not a Roku, but like, or, but like, I've been doing those, like you said, since I was little. I had a cell phone at 14 years old. And they didn't, like, my dad didn't get a cell phone until I was 17. And even then it was like a little turtle shell phone. Like
a flip phone.
Yeah. Well, no, it was like even worse than a flip phone. It was like one of those real turtle shell, like $20
battery, like pack. Yeah, yeah. I know what you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. But it's like, you know, it's having that compassion as well.
You know, yeah. that has me thinking about how the different generations show up to telehealth therapy, you know? And I have Gen Z front camera, them like this, bun on top of their head. Hey, in bed. You know, hanging out. And then 100%. I have, yeah, yeah. And valid, show up however you want. Right. And then I have Gen X, and even now that I'm thinking, I have them messed up, like Boomer and Gen X are showing up fully prepped on their computer, like ready, like 10 minutes before they've already logged in. It's like the cutest thing, but either way they're showing up, they're just showing up a little differently. And I think, you know, whatever is in your comfort, but I find it so endearing, you know? And either way they're preparing, you know, it's cute.
Well, and I think too, like that impacts what they look for in providers too. Like I remember talking, like I want a more laid back there. Like I always say, there's two types of therapists. There's like a therapist like me where I'm like super hands on that type of stuff. And then I always like say that there's this type of therapist, and this type of therapist is great for some people. And like, I joke because I have someone close to me who's looking for a therapist now, and they want the glasses on the tip of their nose therapist. That's what they're looking for.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
therapist for everybody.
Live your best life. Let's do it. And so I think that's important too, is even understanding like every generation too is going to look for something different for their mental health as well, as far as like a provider.
That's a really good point, actually.
Yeah. And thinking about just like even showing up to therapy, and now considering like my millennial brain, like a lot of times, you know, we'll jump to, hey, go on to Psychology Today or Open Path Collective or Therapy Den or Therapy for Black Girl, whatever resource it is. But if I were to give that to like, well, one, I was going to say my grandma, she doesn't even know how to use a computer. Like we tried like years ago. And she was like, why would I need to use a computer? She's 96. Like she doesn't need a computer. But even like, you know, like my parents are savvy in computers and stuff, but going back to what you were saying, Justin, like giving them a website to navigate is probably going to be more stressful and overwhelming. They're like, screw this, versus like going to their doctor and their doctor sending a referral to a therapist and showing up that way. Or even you brought up telehealth, K10, you know, and I only work with Gen Z and Gen L. Like I literally have no millennial clients. As a sidebar, I remember a few years ago when I had the realization that not a single one of my clients were alive for 9/11. And I was like, oh my gosh, I am so old. But, you know, they might want to show up in person and don't like the idea of telehealth, because for them, it might be a barrier of trying to figure out how to navigate like an online system. So it is interesting to think about, like, even just if an older generation did want to access therapy, things that we might recommend to another millennial or Gen Zer is not the same avenue to get access to therapy for some older generations.
Yeah. I think just as we talk about, you know, looking at our clients through a cultural lens, I think holding this generational lens, this is why the conversation is so important. Like having respect for the life events they've experienced. We're all living in the now, it's true. But again, if you take anything away from this episode, it's those coming of age events matter greatly. And whatever may be in the now, sure, we're all experiencing it, but we're all experiencing it differently depending on how we grew up. And I think that's the big thing that I can forget a lot in the clients that I work with. I think it's almost easier with teens because I'm in some ways fascinated by their world. But with my older adults, sometimes like I can even forget that, if like we're both here in the now and you're older and you have this wisdom, but your experiences are so vastly different. And that having conversations around mental health, as we've highlighted, is still relatively new. And so like when I could be like, yeah, it's OCD. And like so commonplace, like that's what this means. But that just might be so much harder to grasp.
Mm-hmm. It's true. What do you guys think has contributed to the greater acceptance of mental health among the generations? I know we're talking about a million different generations here, but what do you think are some things that have contributed?
Social media.
That's one. Yeah.
Definitely for like Gen Z millennial. Mm-hmm. I would go back to something KBI said as like more language for things. We actually have more research data, labels, which, you know, we could argue are labels harmful or helpful, but things like that, like more knowledge about these things, more people talking about it. I know I've made this comment on this podcast before, but I grew up in a family. We didn't talk about feelings, emotions, mental health. I became a psychologist. My sister became a social worker. Like,
it's like a pipeline.
It happened. And my parents have gone to therapy themselves since then. And like, even just like one person in the family, usually from a younger generation, like, you know, being more open, educating, and the amount of people in my family that have reached out to me over the years for like, you know, advice, directions on what to do about a friend, all these things that, you know, obviously like 15 years ago, they probably wouldn't have asked me anyways, because I was in, was I still in high school? Nope. I was in college. Anyways, but like, I think just, you know, people talking about it more, having labels like for things, just increase awareness, breaking down stigma. I know I'm just listing off a bunch of stuff.
Yeah,
it is that. And it's having the conversations. And the first thing I think of is having them in primary education.
Yeah,
it's what almost everybody, again, disparity still exists, but it's what almost everybody goes through. Like, I literally remember in the late for me, but like 2003, of the conversation around bullying had just started. And it was like the first time ever a school was going to talk about something closely related to mental health. They're like, it was related to Columbine and shootings and sort of this idea of the outcast or rogue student. But like, I can't even explain another way. No one had ever said a single word of all the words we know in all my time in primary education. The first thing I'd ever heard was, hey, bullying is pretty bad, we think. Like, y'all don't even, like, I can't even explain that. It's not even to say that, of course, bullying still exists. It's not like we eradicated it. But, like, I know conversations are happening about anxiety, depression, and mental health. And, again, a lot of disparities and differences within each school. But to go your whole primary education and at the very end of mine, they're like, yeah, bullying might not be the best. Like, it's such a difference. And I love that Gen Z can roll up and be like, yeah, I know my diagnosis or something I struggle with and my friends. And I love it, but it's so different than what I experienced.
Yeah. When you were saying that, Justin, I'm like, okay, yeah, bullying conversations. Yet we were taught the DARE program at like 7. Like, say no to drugs. I'm like,
it doesn't work.
And the DARE program doesn't work. It's been shown over and over that it's not effective. But like, you know what? We should say no to drugs. I'm not endorsing drug use. But like, at 8, it would probably have been more helpful. I'm just reflecting on my experience. Like, I have this vivid memory. I think I might have been 9 of like taking a standardized test and realizing like it was a 3-day thing and realizing like 2 pages got stuck together and like accident. Like, I skipped one and probably unsurprisingly, like, literally had, now I can look back and realize it was a panic attack because I like freaked out. And so, you know, jokes aside about my high strung anxiety, like, it would have been so helpful at 9 to have had language of like, this is anxiety, this is stress, this is overwhelm, rather than me just like crying uncontrollably during a standardized test because I missed a page. I did learn to say no to drugs when a random stranger on the street offers me drugs.
I've not been offered free drugs by a stranger on the street in my entire life. Never once have someone been like, hey, you want some free LSD? You want some free cocaine? Never once. I'm like,
yeah.
What the hell?
I mean, I agree with you. I have a weird take on Dare. I think it was an attempt. Like,
oh, yeah.
It was an attempt.
What else were they supposed to do? Honestly, I don't know.
And it was like somebody trying to throw a dart at a dartboard and hitting like the outer circle were 0 points. And it's like, at least you threw something. Like, you recognize, hey, there's a problem. We don't think these drugs are good for people. Let's try this. I'm always happy to try something, even if it doesn't work out. Because what was the solution before that? Nothing. I got a cool beer t-shirt. Yeah.
I'm even thinking, too, about, like, what we're talking about, like, life events. Wasn't, like, the war on drugs that was, like, the thing? And was that the reason for the DARE program?
Probably.
Somewhere
in there.
The war on drugs was directly related to racism, of course.
Yeah.
And the prison system. And there's a lot of good documentaries about that on Netflix.
There's a lot going on there.
But yeah, I think, like, language, you know, over time has been helpful. Like even as someone in the... Like, I graduated high school in 2010, so in those 4 years, like, I remember having a friend who self-harmed. I remember the reason why I got into the field was because I had a friend die by suicide, and it wasn't really ever talked about. Like, it was, they came in, they told us that my friend had died, and they were like, there's a counselor available, but good luck. And, like, my friend, like, we just kind of moved past it because we didn't have language for what was going on versus, like, if that were to happen now, kids have some of that language.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Know what else we have language for? The Google Scholar Shorts.
We got the numbers, the language, the formulas.
The limit doesn't exist.
The research, the limitations, the
future
methods.
Directions.
All of the above. Okay, so I know we've been talking about kind of, you know, differences in perception of mental health and therapy and things like that. But the question I'm going to pose to you, because we haven't really talked about, like, just how mental health impacts the different generations, so kind of looking at it a different way. So what generational differences do you think occurred with regard to mental health in the early months of the pandemic? So if we're looking across generations, do you feel like there are any mental health differences?
So you're talking about, like, rise in certain diagnoses amongst generations?
Yeah.
I think younger generations sought therapy more than older generations, but that's not really a leap.
I think younger generations acknowledge their mental health more than older generations.
Right.
I agree.
But older generations, I think, are so used to working in person. And they're just used to that in-person contact. Whereas I think Gen Z and, like, younger generations are used to maybe seeing their doctor through telehealth every now and then, or calling them on the, like, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So this article came out in 2023. I realize it's 2024, but we're literally recording this on the second day. So there's not much research out there. I also gathered this article still in 2023, but the data was collected in early 2020, the first few months of the pandemic. So, like you all said, overall, individuals that are Gen Z and millennial self-reported more negative outcomes for perceived stress, loneliness, fatigue, motivation, physical activity, and concentration. Most notably, provisional rates of diagnosis, because obviously they weren't diagnosing, for major depressive disorder for individuals in Gen Z and millennials were significantly greater than Gen X and baby boomer, although all groups self-reported a higher rate of major depressive disorder compared to the prior 12 months. So although exactly like, was it K-10 you said, like, would be more aware of their mental health? So although absolutely Gen Z and millennials reported more symptoms, Gen X and baby boomers were also reporting more symptoms compared to pre-pandemic rates. Likewise, the rates of provisional diagnosis for generalized anxiety disorder in Gen Z, millennial, and Gen X were significantly higher than those in the baby boomer group. And then when they looked at sleep behavior changes, I added this result in just for K-10. 40 to 50% of individuals in Gen X, Millennial, and Gen Z reported decreases in sleep during the initial phase of the pandemic. And there was also a notable significant increase in alcohol use for Millennial and Gen Z groups compared to baby boomers. And then there was no difference between Gen X and baby boomers for alcohol use. So overall, yes, Gen Z and Millennials, worse mental health, but we did see Gen X also self-reporting worse mental health in some areas like sleep, anxiety, depression.
I have more reason as to why that probably is.
Let me hear it.
I think the landing of the significant event that was COVID developmentally impacts Gen Z and Millennial more. Mm-hmm. I was just reading before this, the majority of Millennials in 2018 were in poverty, which, again, a lot of Millennials were getting into their career, whatever. Mm-hmm. But you think about that, of like most Millennials in 2020 that I knew were not financially stable. Most Gen Zers are going through big life moments like prom and, you know, high school graduation and this and that. What a significant event to get erased, where it's not to say it didn't impact Gen X or baby boomers, but you were later in your careers, likely probably established, again, individual differences. But I think having the language, sure, being more up on mental health, sure. But I think if an event is going to land in history, the younger you are, the worse of an impact it's going to have. Hill I'm willing to die on.
I agree with you 90%, because I think with older generations, they were probably worried about their feelings of like, oh my God, am I immunocompromised? Like, I think they may have had more health anxiety potentially, maybe. I'm just throwing it out there. I don't know for sure. Like, oh my gosh, like this COVID thing's going to kill me. I got to like stay inside, and how that may have impacted mental health. But if we really think about it too, Gen Z is really aware of these things as well. Like, okay, let me mask up. Like, they're really good about all that stuff too. So I don't know. I tend to think too, it affected everybody in different ways, you know?
I'd be fascinated to find out in baby boomers if the level of concern was above Gen Z. I don't think it was.
Yeah.
And I would agree with you, of being older, you would think it sort of should be. Again, this isn't taking anything away from people who had negative health outcomes through COVID that were disastrous. Of course, that's awful and horrible. But I think on the majority, I'd be willing to bet that younger generations had more anxiety and stress than older.
I think when you relate it to the life transitions, though, I could see that. You know what I mean? Like, when I think about prom, like all those big things, like the notable things that you feel like, I'm putting my whole life into this right now, you know, that had to have been devastating.
So I didn't include this in the results because it wasn't necessarily related directly to mental health, but they did look at concerns about the pandemic. Interestingly, the only two areas, oh, there was three areas actually, that were no significant differences across generations. One was COVID infection. And like,
really,
there was no differences. I don't know what measure they use, but literally looking across, Gen Z had a standard or raw score of 6.8, Millennial 6.5, Gen X 6.9, Baby Boomer 6.8.
Like,
literally,
fascinating.
For the researcher, P, it was 0.419.
Like, the research
nowhere near,
not significant.
But things like employment and finances, so going to what Justin was saying about like career and stuff, Millennial and Gen X had the highest rate of anxiety.
I can believe that.
That's so reasonable. Yeah.
And then like they looked at childcare. Interestingly, so they had concern about elderly parents. And once again, Millennial and Gen X were most concerned. Like, so, I mean, they did.
Oh,
look,
interesting.
So
I see where.
Obviously, as always,
yeah.
We'll link the article, but. Mm-hmm. It was funny that you all rigged that up. I was like, actually, I have some statistics.
That's helpful, though. Yeah, because you think and you kind of like stereotype in a way. Like, you know, like maybe they're concerned. Yeah. And it's good to know the research.
Yeah.
So interesting.
It is.
Know what else
the polls
is interesting?
Are also interesting.
Yeah. Our polls. Also, shout out to you two for having a discussion so I could pull them up, because it's always stressful when I have to go in from Google Scholars to the polls.
Noted for the future.
So I had the privilege of doing the last polls of 2023. So the first question I asked, what generation are you? The options I gave were baby boomer, Gen X, millennial, and Gen Z. And then I said, if another generation let us know here, I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I did that thinking in case we had any Gen Alpha or like, the silent generation. People living or listening. We got none of that. It was all like Zillennial.
Yeah, exactly.
Xennial. So, but what do you think our group members are mostly? Baby boomers, Gen X, millennial, Gen Z.
Millennial.
I think millennial too. Yeah.
KBI is muted, so we can't hear what her thoughts are.
Millennial.
Yes. Overwhelmingly so. 65% of those that responded to the polls are millennial, followed by Gen Z at 28%, then Gen X at 7%, with baby boomer at 1%.
Let's go, boomers!
I know!
Let's go. So we're 1% of boomers. Let's go!
How many people? Click on it. Tell me. I want to know how many people. How many boomers?
6.
How many people responded? Baby boomer, 5.
I want to know who five are. Let's go.
We got 5.
Legends. That's 5. Hold on.
5 absolute legends. They don't listen to the podcast. They just
thanks for being here.
I was about to say I can read their names, but I don't know if we have.
They found
I'll
us.
Do initials. MK, LSG, LZ, SHN, FSC. There you
love
go.
That.
Those are our 5 boomers. Thank you all for joining us. Okay. What generation do you think is the most accepting of mental health? Baby boomer, Gen X, millennial, Gen Z.
Gen Z.
Gen Z.
Yep. Overwhelmingly so. 65% said Gen Z, 32% said millennial, 3% said Gen X, and 0% said boomer. Then I said, according to a 2023 survey, since the pandemic began, blank more Gen Zers have seen a therapist than boomers. So 2 times more, 3 times more, 4 times more, or 5 times more.
4.
I'm just guessing 5. I don't.
The lowest one. I blanked out because I was trying to like figure out the question.
So you say 2. Okay, yeah. You are all wrong. The answer was actually 3. 3
Damn.
Times more.
Dang.
But most of our group members thought it was 4 times, and I was actually surprised it was only 3 times. But 4 times came in and with 45%, followed by 5 times at 32, 3 times at 20, 2 times at 2. But and it was just a survey off of Value Penguin that I found. We can link it if people want. It was interesting. It wasn't a scientific study. It was just a survey. Okay. According to that same 2023 survey, what percent of millennials have seen a therapist since the beginning of the pandemic? 57%, 32%, 26%, or 11%?
32.
I was going to say. Justin, what are you going to say?
Yeah, I was thinking 32.
I know.
So our group members also thought 32 at 51%, followed by 57% at 25%. This is confusing when we do percentage. Followed by 26 at 22% and 11 at 3%. The answer was actually only 26.
Mm. Really?
Wow. I was surprised. When we actually got a message about this, it was like, why are the numbers so low?
Yeah.
Bear.
But then if you think about it, like there's a difference between actually accessing therapy,
right.
It's
versus like getting access. So like I pulled up the survey. And so like, even though 26% of millennials had seen a therapist, an additional 32% said no, but I'm thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that's 58%.
Yeah.
Well, so if we think of like access and stuff.
And I think our views can be skewed based on who we're surrounded by, right? Like Jess, you said, like, I don't think I have a friend right now who either isn't or hasn't been in therapy. And so when you think about that, 100% of the people in your lives that are millennials have like gone to therapy.
Yeah.
And so I wonder too, like how much that skews what our viewpoint might be as like a whole.
Absolutely.
It's good to consider that.
Yeah. And those were our polls.
Well, it's time for group member questions. It's the start of the year, knocking the rust off in the transitions. So let's get into it. We always love your questions. Wherever you are, whoever you are, thanks for just taking the time and dropping a little question to us. This was asked in every single way possible from every state, country, across the globe. I think it was the most repeated asked question we've ever had of any episode. I was in like, it was like 14 I'd counted, then I quit counting of how many people asked this exact question, like Megan from Michigan or Alexia. How do we help other generations be more open to therapy? Thinking about therapy, how it could be helpful, or honoring mental health.
I was going to say, the first thought that came to my mind was being open about our experiences in therapy. Like the conversation mm-hmm. has to start with a person. And yeah. so if you've had experience in therapy, like being open and talking about how it helps you, obviously you don't have to share too many details, especially with people that, because not everybody's privileged to know your innermost things. But like if you've had positive experience in therapy, you know, sharing those, or I'm even thinking of us as like mental health professionals, you know, just talking about our jobs and what we do and different ways that we help can help people. Like I said, I have a bunch of like, you know, my aunts and uncles that will reach out, not for advice necessarily for themselves, but like, oh, I have a friend that has this, which I'm sure 10, 15 years ago, they wouldn't have, especially if they didn't know somebody mm-hmm. that was a mental health professional. What were you going to say, KBI?
I was just going to say, kind of coming back to the compassion aspect and having that compassion that every generation is experiencing those things differently. And like you said, Jess, like talking about your own experience, maybe putting the feelers out there, but not pressuring someone. I think that that is a quick way, especially like that older generation, to get them to not engage is to push and push and push. Versus like you said, like just talking about that experience.
I really like that you both brought that up because I think about like, how do you get like, how's like a, what's like a foot in the door technique? You know what I mean? For someone like who's trying to get into therapy. And I think about older generations, if I'm thinking just the stereotypical, right? Like older generations might not seek out therapy as much as younger generations do. And I think sometimes it's helpful if they know somebody on social media or in media in general who they respect, who is a mental health professional, you know, or somebody that they might listen to or learn from. And I think, you know, social media could help with that if they end up finding someone who they want to listen to, psychologist, therapist, whatever, could open their eyes a little more to like mental health in general. And then maybe they might be open to therapy, but then I also want to be open to the fact that not everybody has access to therapy. You know, even if you want somebody from a different generation so desperately to seek out therapy, there's just so many barriers. Like we talked about in our discussion of like the stigma or, you know, what is this going to help with and stuff like that. So I do think education is a really good, like kind of like what you guys both alluded to is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I also think you can, you know, see where someone's at, like do a little assessment, ask somebody like, mom, what's your thoughts on therapy? How have your thoughts on therapy changed or stayed the same, you know, as you were growing up? I think sometimes you get people talking about the topic versus being like, mom, you got generalized anxiety disorder. Probably not going to land well on your boomer mom who hasn't heard that term and is worried you're insulting. You know, I don't even know. But like instead starting the conversation, like how do you think about mental health and therapy and kind of seeing where they're at, what they say. Could I even think from then you can share your own experiences like everyone's alluded to. Like, yeah, you know, I was skeptical of therapy or, you know, I struggle with depression myself but I like assessing. I like just going right to the source. Back, what do you think about therapy? You know, sometimes, again, that can highlight where someone's at versus trying to start a conversation where you jump in the middle. Why don't we start at the beginning, see what someone's perceptions are?
Yeah. I love that, Justin. And reflecting on what everybody's been saying, another thought I had, especially thinking about how therapy is inaccessible to so many people, or even that like foot in the door technique, you know, if you do your assessment and your mom is like, nope, therapy is for insert stigmatizing language here or whatever, even like other ways to maybe be more open to mental health, like listening to a podcast, or like I can think of, you know, movies I've watched with my parents that maybe are better representations of mental health and like having conversations about that and things like that to like subtly, slowly destigmatize and, you know, I don't know, help broaden perspective of therapy or do a different perspective without being like, hey, I think you have generalized anxiety disorder and you need to go see a shrink. Like, that's not going to be helpful.
Right. It's not going to go over well.
But yeah, but accessibility. So like podcasts like this, or I mean, we did that whole episode on like movies, TV, something like that, or books, you know, hey, I read this really great book. Do you want to read it? And go from there.
Love that. We also love Amy from Connecticut. Ask this great question. I'm curious to hear you guys' thoughts. What are the generational differences in why people seek therapy? I just had a quick insight I was going to share off the jump. So I got a private practice. I'm always curious what people fill out on my website of why you're seeking therapy. I've just noticed this. The younger generation, millennial and Gen Z, will just slap a disorder in that box.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
CPTSD. Neurodivergent. They'll be like, you know, persistent depressive disorder. They'll be like, you know, there'll be a diagnosis in that box. My Gen X and Boomer clients, it's narrative. And almost like life changes, like these kind of bigger, I don't know what to call them, like descriptors of like going through a lot of life changes, tough times right now. And it's a little more narrative of someone explaining something. Mm-hmm. So for what that's worth, I've noticed that in 4 years of my private practice of just generational differences of what people name.
I love that you said that because obviously I don't have the privilege of getting to work with older individuals since I work literally with Gen Z and some Gen Alpha. So exactly. Why are you coming to therapy? And it's like anxiety, depression. I work obviously with a lot of LGBTQ plus youth that, but thinking of like older adults in my life that I know have gone to therapy, it's always been like, oh, I'm now retired or maybe marital issues or loss of a spouse. Like it's like a life, exactly like you said, a life transition that brought them, not like, I think I have depression. It's I'm going through this difficult thing. Yeah. Maybe you do have depression. But yeah, I mean, I think of just think of stages of life or think of stages of my life so far and different reasons I've sought therapy. Why I sought therapy at 15 was very different than me seeking therapy at 32 and the reasons why.
I'm just thinking about my client base and I have to agree with both of you. I even think too that like older generations that I work with, they want, and I don't know if this is a stereotype or just the client specific clients that I see in my private practice, but I noticed that a lot of my older clients rely more on my expertise with like strategies and skills and like, what can I do about it? Like I need to get better. Right. And then a lot of my younger clients want that, but they're more focused on the process oriented part of it. Like I know that the processing part will help me feel better. Therefore, I want to like live in this. Whereas I think the older generations that I work with, again, this is a very small sample from my private practice. They'll say like, okay, this is my issue. What do I do about it? You know what I mean? And then it's like, kind of like I have to switch a little, which is totally cool. Every client needs something different. But I noticed that we're a lot more structured in those sort of sessions. I don't know if it's everybody or just the clients I see, but that's what I notice. Just in terms of what therapy looks like. But I agree with you guys. A lot of them will come to me for like, I'm having relationship difficulties. That's just like in the intake form, like relationship issues. And then when it's a younger client, it's like, I think I might have anxious attachment disorder or something, or anxious attachment in general, or something like that. I'm like, okay, got it.
Julie from the Mitten State. Hey, how about Michigan being in the national championship? Julie, you might not care, but hey, we'll shout it out.
Yeah, it was a good game.
That part. Sorry.
We got some good college football action, which has
been so cool.
About 1% of our listeners care about that.
Like, it'd be interesting to talk forever about sports.
Mixed sportsters.
The Michigan-Alabama game was good.
So good.
It was.
You know what else is good? Julie's two-part question right here.
Let's go, Julie.
Do you think there's a correlation between the rise of social media and the age number of individuals going to therapy that has to be fielded by KBI for no reason at all. I'm just saying. And the second part being, has the number of older generation individuals seeking therapy increased post-social media and post-COVID?
Ask me that first part again.
Yeah. Do you think there's a correlation between the rise of social media and the age / number of individuals going to therapy? Like, is social media, you know, having an impact of people going to therapy? There's a few different ways you could look at that, but.
I think.
That's a really good question.
I feel like yes. Like, I don't think it's like this overwhelmingly, like, this is the reason. I think that it does play a part in, again, the additional language. Like we were just talking about the younger generation using anxious attachment style and all of that. Like, they have these words now that, you know, I didn't even, like, it existed when I was a teenager, but that I didn't know what that word was. The word that I had was sadness, and like, I didn't even depression. I didn't even have the word for. So I think it does play a part, absolutely, in even just the normalizing of going, and it feeling not as like isolating, because I feel like Jess said, like, when I went to therapy as a kid, I felt like I was the only person who was doing it. Whereas now, like, you don't feel like the only person's doing it because people are talking about it more.
I agree with that. And to answer part of the second question about, like, has the number of older generation seek therapy increased post-social media and post-COVID? I don't know about social media, but pulling from the Value Penguin article I referred to in the polls, they found that of any age group, of individuals that had seen a therapist since March of 2020, 72% of those people started seeing a therapist after the pandemic started. So I definitely think the pandemic, for me, for older generations at least, I think the pandemic probably had more of an impact than social media. That's based on nothing other than my brain thinking it. But I think, you know, and we've talked about this on this podcast, I've had this conversation, the pandemic, especially those early months, lockdown, was the first time in many people's lives that they actually felt some type of mental health concern, anxiety, depression, things like that. Do I think social media may also contribute to some of the older people seeking therapy? Yeah, I'm thinking especially like Gen X, maybe like Gen X, like born in the 70s. But I'm thinking like my parents, the only social media they use is Facebook. I'm going to be honest, I don't think Facebook is going to convince them to go to therapy. Because when I think of like social media platforms that are like talking more about it, I think it is the ones that are more likely used by younger generations, Instagram, TikTok, Discord, those things. I don't know if anybody has different thoughts.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it could be a lot of those things. I also think that, again, really small sample of my private practice, because that's the only thing I have to go off of right now. But a lot of the clients that I see, it's because their kids are in therapy, like their millennial daughters or sons or whoever, you know what I mean? So I think they've seen the benefit for them and they're like, let me just give this thing a shot. You know what I mean? So I think that they're experimental in that way. If they see it, you know, if it's modeled, doesn't mean it happens for everybody. But I do wonder if like Instagram is helpful. TikTok could be spotty, in my opinion, with therapy, you know, just really depends on who you find on there and what information is being put out there. The source that I think is the most helpful is actually YouTube, because you could get verified as a mental health licensed mental health professional. So, you know, it's coming from at least somebody who's licensed. So I think that's helpful, but yeah, I don't know. I do think social media has something to do with it, but I also think conversations at home help.
Yusra from Iraq. Love it. What experience, this question really, I was like, when I read it, I was like, this is so interesting. What experience have you had from other generations that was unexpected and the opposite of the stereotype?
Oh, this is a good one. Because we have to hit, at least I'm just going to speak for myself. I feel like you have to hit on almost like your internal biases of maybe stereotypes that you might have about different generations, right? And I think whenever initially when I opened up my private practice, whenever I would have a client that was older than me, I would think like, oh, I don't know how this is going to go over. I don't know if they're going to like therapy, you know? And those happened to be my clients who like got better so quick because they took their healing journey very seriously. And I was very shocked. I was very, very shocked in the beginning. And that was a bias that I had for whatever reason that I had to work through. But I was thinking like, oh, if they're older than me, are they going to respect what I have to say and stuff like that? And it's so interesting because a lot of the clients that I have that are older than me, we have a really great dynamic in therapy. It's like really fun, you know? And they're great. But that was one thing that I was very, very shocked by when I started to see clients in different generations, because I was thinking they've lived so much more life than me. You know what I mean? Like they have so much more lived experience than me. And then you have to think like, I'm an expert in psychology. They're an expert in their own life. Right. And then you kind of like marry the two, but yeah, it was really unexpected. And I really enjoy working with people who are older than me now. It's been a great journey.
This one's hard for me since I'm so condensed. Like the one thing that comes to mind going back to social media, because I think we would all agree that like Gen X has probably more language than any other generation about mental health. Exactly what Justin said. They're going to like come in with a diagnosis like, hey, I think I have this and this is why. I have had a few teenage clients that do not have social media. And that like usually throws me off, honestly.
Oh,
boy. Because like I come in with this like bias that like, oh, well, they probably saw this on like TikTok or they saw this on whatever. I can think of one in particular that I've worked with, not on social media. I think like maybe she had an Instagram that she like didn't use ever. But the feel working with her was and she was just very wise beyond her years anyways. But like, I felt like I was definitely working with maybe like a millennial or Gen Xer, like somebody that would go to like Google to look up like symptoms or WebMD. I know we made joke about that in a recent episode. WebMD versus like going to Instagram and TikTok. So having to check my biases of like, where did you get this information? Oh, you actually got it from like a medical journal or like things like that versus, oh, I saw a Instagram. But that's the only thing that comes to mind because I'm just so condensed in my population.
Yeah.
That's so interesting.
Not to be repetitive because I agree with a lot that's been said, but I actually was thinking non-clinical with this question and not to out anyone in my family, but I've been surprised by older people in my own family being curious, asking questions, engaging in collecting information that's not through the internet, but wanting to have the conversation with me as a psychologist about a lot of socio-political issues that are related to mental health. Which I'm sure you can narrow in what those conversations were. But for me, I'm like, I appreciate you having the conversation and wanting to collect information. Like when you could keep your head in the sand, ignore it, and be like, well, I don't have any personal experience with this, so who cares? I think sometimes you get more information from a back and forth with a real life person, and it often feels too scary to ask. Because again, I say all the time, all of us are ignorant about something. You don't know what that thing is. Or you might kind of be aware of it and feels too scary to ask the questions. And Google's great. YouTube's awesome, like we've been saying. But I think having a back and forth with a trusted person, and I've had some really cool experiences with that. I'm thinking of people in my family that I'm like, I'm surprised you're having this conversation with me. And I feel pleasantly surprised by it.
Now that we're thinking non-clinical, my grandpa was always like, why'd you become a psychologist? Why didn't you become like a regular doctor, putting it in quotes, right? And I'm like, because like people need mental health help, you know? And then towards the end of his life, he was asking me a lot of questions. Like, what does anxiety feel like? Like, what is it? Do I have it? Like what? And he was really open about it. I was like, damn, pops. Okay. Sounds like my career paid off, but you know, whatever, you know, it was really cute though, because I think like you said, Justin, if people feel comfortable enough to like have those conversations at home, it could be so valuable. You know, for their own healing. And you never know what you'll find out. because I think we are all ignorant about something, like you said. So
totally. Sophia from the swamps of Florida. I don't know. She's probably from Miami, like living in Brickell. But Sophia from Florida, while younger generations are more open to therapy and self-care, how can we move the conversation towards the realities of living with mental illness? And how can we as a society be more inclusive and understanding?
I feel like so, I can interpret this a couple of ways.
I guess like my thought, because we've talked a lot about social media and especially like younger generations and stuff. And I think we all talk about how social media is a highlight reel. And I think if we're going to use social media as a source of like information, it's having people like the four of us who are licensed mental health professionals, like providing accurate evidence-based information, but also those with like lived experience sharing their experiences, but not a way that's like, I don't want to say to glamorize it, because I don't think people intentionally do that, but I think that's how some people interpret it. But, you know, talking about the good days, talking about the challenges, like a much mm-hmm. more balanced approach. And I recognize like what I'm saying is putting a lot on individual people that are being vulnerable and sharing their lies. But I've had this conversation with a lot of people recently that I've worked with and families and stuff. And, you know, not every day is going to be a good day, but not every day is going to be a bad day. And, you know, recognizing those ups and downs are part of being human, but especially when you live with a mental illness, like you can have major depressive disorder, but one day feel like okay. And that doesn't mean the next day is going to be okay or great, but it also doesn't mean that every day is going to be the worst day. Mm-hmm. But outside of social media, like that's where my mind goes, because that's where the younger generations are getting a lot of their mm-hmm. information, but just a more balanced approach. I don't know.
Yeah, I was going to, it really feels like a both and, because I'm like, mm-hmm. I love the conversations about therapy and self-care, but I also love the videos when somebody's just sharing their experience, exactly like just said, of talking about what it feels like to have persistent depressive disorder. Because mm-hmm. the nuanced vulnerability that someone can explain of what it feels like to live their life is, it's intriguing and interesting and connecting in a way that like a book about persistent depressive disorder just isn't going to be. And I agree with Jess. It's like, you don't want to put the burden on people to do it, but I do think it hits different. And I, of course, I know each one of us have done it through our own social media. Talk about living with OCD, what that feels like. I think that vulnerability goes a long way. And I specifically, I think vulnerability from professionals hits different. A lot of us can be very, again, here's three ways that you can deal with stress. And those videos are amazing. We love those videos. I also think it's different when a professional says, hey, I struggle with PTSD, and this mm-hmm. is what that experience has been like for me.
Well, guys, that was a great conversation. Like, I thought we had like really good balance between, you know, talking about all the different generations, the good, the bad, the in-between. So I'm excited to see how this conversation even continues as the next generations come up. But if for all of you guys, all of our group members, make sure to share this episode with someone that you know, share it with a boomer, share it with a Gen Zer, maybe share it with the silent generation, show them how to use Spotify, pull it up on YouTube. Listen to it with them. Who knows? But remember to like, share, and subscribe. And we will see you guys next week in group therapy. Bye.
Bye.
See you guys.
Peace.